Calling cause number 13-19-311-CV, the City of Brownsville, Texas. City Attorney Martinez et al. Versus Brownsville GMS, LTD, and Michael Bennett. What says the City of Brownsville? Mr. Nevada, whenever you're ready to proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Justices Benavides and Jose Tijerina. Ricardo Navarro for the City of Brownsville appellants. In our brief, you know, we have three main points. One of them, of course, has to do with the striking of the judge. I'm going to gloss over that point because it's going to be addressed in more detail by Mr. Aguilar. I think what I would like to focus on mainly is the fact that in this temporary injunction, we're here mainly on an issue of injunctive relief. The issues are
subsumed. Mr. Nevada, just so I understand, you're not waiving the issue, but you understand that if the issue affects both cases on the objection to the
That's correct, and I know that Mr. Aguilar is already planning on focusing that, so I'd rather not spend a lot of my time on it. We included it in our brief to make sure that it's preserved. I am absolutely not waiving that issue, but as you noted, the issues overlap the two appeals, so
I'd rather
let him brief that portion or Mr. Drinkard on rebuttal if necessary.
Okay. Perfect.
My focus really has to do with the real meat of the case in terms of the merits, which has to do with the fact that this is an injunction that enjoins the city from pursuing independently of Chapter 252 a waste management contract. Which it was allowed to do. The concern that we have about the temporary injunction is that it seems to foreshadow the court's view that somehow ultimate permanent injunctive relief is somehow appropriate in this case or could be appropriate in this case. We still have another phase of discovery in the case that is pending below. Because the matter is stayed. I think the court is aware that we had filed a jurisdictional plea below, which got stayed. We tried to get this up here before you to all be heard together. It was determined that that could not be done. So that's still back down there. But the temporary injunction hearing order itself presents a lot of the substance of these issues. And our concern here is that the main thing is that Chapter 252 does not provide the ultimate relief that is being requested here. If there's a claim here in damages at all, then obviously that needs to be pursued in that matter. But the record is very clear that the underlying agreement, the underlying ordinance, which is a type of franchise, frankly, because the nature of the work being done, the waste collection, falls squarely within the police powers of the municipality.
I've got a question that I'm going to ask you and the appellee's counsel as well, and two for you and three maybe for them if we get to that. But
okay.
Whether it's a 252 contract or not, do you believe that the city has the right to reject all of those bids under any circumstances if they don't feel like any of them meet
the city
the requirements?
Yes, Your Honor.
Even if they do meet the requirements, they have the right to reject those, don't they?
The law under 252 is pretty clear that the city has the absolute right to reject these bids. And here we have in controversy not just RFP 1, but RFP 2. And so in both of those cases, the city chose to reject it. Now, there's been challenges, collateral challenges to that, as to RFP 1 having to do with these off-the-dais comments attributed to Cesar De Leon.
Sure, but my question is, they have the absolute right to do that.
They have the absolute right to reject it, and they did it in the RFP 1 correctly, and they did it in RFP 2. Now, there were some concerns with RFP 2, which were resolved in the meeting of April 16th. That was a meeting, you know, in which we had been retained at that point to assist the city attorney in advising the council. But they did reject all those bids.
And then I think it would you agree that it's clear that under the police powers or the health and safety exception that solid waste collection does not have to go through 252.
It does not have to go through 252. There's some evidence in the record that's a little confusing because I think the department head was under that belief, but that's not our legal research on that point. Our legal research is that that's not necessarily the case. City Commission was so advised, and they elected to go with this other more direct route, which was enjoined. But they have the absolute right to reject these bids. They were rejected. The efforts now attacking...
So let me, and that's where I became confused about this direct negotiations that was discussed and how that plays in under these RFPs. Isn't there, because there's direct negotiations, now being able to bring a cause of action under 252 because of these direct negotiations that were given to the city manager?
The concern was that as long as you're in an 252 process, that the city is vulnerable to being challenged on how it handled the 252 process. But having concluded the 252 process, then the city is free to pursue direct negotiations if it wants to, which is what they elected to do. The meeting of April 16 is very critical because it's our position that it legitimately and properly cleared the table. It clearly closed the 252 process that had been admittedly fumbled somewhat earlier in the year. Under new management, I might add, we had a new city attorney, a new city manager that had just come in, and they were trying to finish up a project that had been hanging around for a long time. But they cleared the table on that, and then they elected to, the concern there was that they were going to get sued not by GMS, but by Redfish. I think the record's pretty clear on that. But that they could then, having cleared the table on 252, gone to a direct negotiation process, and that's what was enjoined. So we were somewhat surprised that the court came in quite strong. Truncating the TRO, I mean, that's understandable, but then truncating deadlines, the issue, of course, on the disqualification or the striking of the judge, that'll be handled separately, but that was there. And then in the injunction process, the court seemed to have, in our view, overreacted to the fumbling around that the city had engaged, had fallen into in trying to resolve
this issue.
Judge Pates
makes some pretty strong language during the hearing about stopping the city of Brownsville from paraphrasing almost like shenanigans.
Well,
and so doesn't he have the right to do so under this chapter to do what he did? Because we're under an abuse of discretion standard. So isn't Judge Pate within his rights to do what he did?
Well, it is an abuse of discretion standard. However, ultimately, the relief under 252 is not available. And he basically put us into a continuing contract by injunction. And I think that's the concern that we have, is that basically continued this agreement. There's not even a contract. There's a holdover provision, a 30-day holdover provision, which he enjoined the city to stay on, even dictated new terms in his verbal order, and we think that was an abuse of discretion in that respect. So until this thing...
So it wasn't just a stopping of the negotiation, but was the enforcement of this month-to-month agreement with GMS.
Enforcement of the month-to-month agreement the original order didn't even have a trial date.
What is your belief that appellee's probable right to recovery? What do you think that they are looking for ultimately?
Well, they appear to be looking for an award of another 5-year contract by injunction. That somehow they're going to say, well, the city had no discretion to reject these bids. The city had to either award it on the first one or the second one. There's questions of latches related to the first one. There seems to be the notion that, well, we'll just undo some of these actions that were done and through the Open Meetings Act, and that somehow this is going to end up with GMS keeping this contract under an injunction, which is what we think is inappropriate. That's where the abuse of discretion lies. If they have a remedy, it's a damage remedy. They were clear about what the profit on this contract was, And if they've wrongfully been deprived of it, then there's a measure of damages there that is apparently ascertainable, which means injunctive relief is inappropriate. So I'm not saying the city can't, you know, do things that might open itself to a damages claim. It's possible. But injunctive relief that, you know, grants them the continuing contract or the franchise, really, it's a we keep using the term contract, but it's a franchise by injunction. And that's where the court abused its discretion. Thank you very much. I see that my time is up.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. As the trial court correctly observed at the end of the temporary injunction hearing, what should have been an orderly bidding process became a mess of the city's own making. The trial court properly granted injunctive relief to preserve the status quo while the parties are in the process of trying to untangle the city's mess in the underlying litigation.
So that's I want to start at where we just finished with Mr. Novato's is, where is your irreparable harm under injunction relief? You have monetary damages that you can receive, so how do you receive your temporary injunction?
The fact that a party can obtain monetary damages for some of its relief doesn't preclude the existence of imminent and irreparable harm. Here, the trial court expressly found that part of the imminent and irreparable harm was the business disruption that GMS has incurred and will continue to incur absent injunctive relief. And that's borne out by the record. There is testimony in the record that because of the unfair process, GMS is at risk of having to lay off employees and potentially go out of business but for the injunctive relief. And this court has recognized that business disruption is proper irreparable harm that can form the basis for a temporary injunction. The point here is that the injunction enables the court to preserve the status quo so that the parties are able to litigate and determine the merits of the underlying issues.
And is that what you're looking for, ultimately, an injunction? Until my understanding of reading the brief and the pleadings was you're not asking for damages for a five-year period that you would have been awarded the contract, or 1 year or 2 year or 3 year. Is that correct?
Well, the real focus of the causes of action that form the basis for the temporary injunction would be a finding from the court that ultimately the process that led to the city's negotiations with Republic were unfair. They violated TOMA. They violated Chapter 252. Those two statutes themselves recognize that a victim of an unfair process is entitled to the remedies
but
under
the
those statutes.
The city is making
provisions.
The argument that once they ceased that and they closed it, whatever mess they created is gone because they've ceased the RFP dealings in the, I believe it's the April meeting. So doesn't that end that discussion at that point? Because well, now we're basically they get to rightfully or unrightfully, they get to call Square X and go, okay, we're done. We're going to try to fix our mess.
Two responses to that, Your Honor. First, I don't think this court needs to reach that issue. That's a merits issue. Mootness is a defense that the trial court has not yet had the opportunity to examine. And as courts across Texas repeatedly have observed, the merits of the underlying cause of action and the merits of any underlying defense are simply not before the trial court or even the court of appeals in a temporary injunction matter. The issue is simply whether the plaintiff has a probable right to success, which only requires some evidence tending to support the plaintiff's causes of action,
and
regardless.
Let me go back to that then, your probable right to recovery, and I asked Mr. Novato the questions, and do you agree that in a 252 process that the city or any city has the right to reject those bids when they come in?
The city has a right to reject bids under Chapter 252. We've never argued to the contrary.
Okay, but then let me ask, then entering into a contract for solid waste collection can also be outside the 252 process.
Sure, but okay. Here the city solicited all bids under Chapter 252. Everyone went to the April 2019 meeting understanding that this was a Chapter 252 process. A Chapter 252 process is a competitive bidding process. Sure, in a fair and competitive bidding process, the city may say, we find no bids that meet our approval and we rejected them. But here, the evidence before the trial court was that at the April 19th, 2019 meeting, the city on the one hand publicly emerged from an executive session and said, we reject all bids, while at the same time authorizing its city manager to do what it couldn't do and enter into an agreement with a party that didn't win the competitive bid. That's not rejecting a bid, that's accepting a bid. And so, that is what Chapter 252
prevents. So what you're arguing is that they didn't reject all the bids. By their actions, they actually accepted a bid in violation of Chapter 252.
In violation of Chapter
252. Even though what they say on the record is they come out and they say, we're rejecting all the bids.
Frankly, from the record before Judge Pate, it appeared to be a pretext. And certainly it was a TOMA violation the way that they handled it, according to the Texarkana Court of Appeals in Olympic Waste.
Well, does a TOMA violation, though, get you that kind of remedy, similar to specific performance or making you sign a contract? I know that there's some administrative fines and other things for the people who violate those. But will that give you or your client the right to enforce a contract that doesn't exist?
Well, we're not asking the trial court or this court to enforce a contract that doesn't exist. Certainly, we asked the trial court for the opportunity to have a fair process, and the first step of that
But isn't that exactly what your TRO is doing? It's enforcing, Judge Pate's order is enforcing the contract of GMS upon the city who doesn't want a contract with GMS anymore. I mean, you say you don't want that, but that's what you're getting.
What the temporary injunction does, it's not a permanent injunction, it's a temporary injunction to preserve the status quo while the parties are litigating the merits of the underlying dispute. And as this court observed in Lugo, that's not a moot issue.
But doesn't Chapter 252 limit injunctive relief to contracts that have been executed?
No, what it says is that a court may enjoin the performance of a contract that violates Chapter 252. Frankly, we're still in the process of trying to discover how far along the city got in its contract negotiations with Republic. We don't know if they executed a contract with Republic or not, but certainly we are entitled to invoke our right under Chapter 252 to enjoin the performance of what would be an invalid contract under Chapter 252. That's exactly the relief that Chapter 252 provides. Similarly, under TOMA, we're entitled to a TOMA declaration that the city's actions were in violation of the Open Meetings Act and that the city needs to conduct a proper process consistent with the Open Meetings Act that would include a full and fair open meetings analysis of the various bids, which did not happen here. Ultimately, what it boils down to is the city's argument that the temporary injunction order does not preserve the status quo. Of course, to preserve the status quo is to maintain the last peaceable position the parties occupied before they had the controversy in issue. And the last peaceable position between the parties was the position before the 2019 meetings that violated the Open Meetings Act, with GMS providing the services that the city needs and the city paying for those.
They were on a month-to-month, right?
That was pretty good, guys.
So wouldn't really their only damage be a month?
Well, it's not a question of damage. It's a question of how best to preserve the status quo while the parties are still litigating the merits of the underlying dispute. The San Antonio Court of Appeals addressed exactly that issue in the Guerra case that I provided to the court yesterday. There, the independent school district sought to reassign an at-will employee. The independent school district there, as the city does here, argues, well, wait a second, we have a right to do whatever we want with this employee. If you are keeping us from reassigning that employee, you are infringing upon our right to exercise whatever method or remedy we want against an at-will employee. San Antonio Court of Appeals said if that were the law, no one could ever issue an injunction to preserve the status quo and keep things in place while the merits of the underlying causes of action are being addressed.
But wouldn't that be more applicable in a situation where, let's say, your client did have the contract and they decided for whatever reason to try to terminate a contract, and then at that point preserving the status quo was to force them to honor the contract pursuant to, you know, just to, yeah, until there was an ultimate resolution. But here, you're preserving the status quo of a month to month. So going back to what Justice Tijerina said, wouldn't that be just limited to the 30-day remedy? I mean, I guess I'm just having a hard time trying to figure out, like, what is your ultimate goal here? Is it to continue having the city go month to month forever, or is it just, if, you know, for them to follow the law and to do what needs to be done to take bids and have your client act as put in a bid and try to acquire a long-term contract? I guess I just don't get it.
Yes, as to the latter. This is a temporary injunction. The purpose of injunctive relief is to prevent irreparable harm from taking place while the parties are litigating the merits of the underlying action. And it's not a permanent injunction. What it does is it affords the parties the ability to be able to litigate the TOMA and Chapter 252 issues precisely to get to the goal ultimately of an order that requires the city to pursue a fair and open process consistent with the requirements of the Texas Open Meetings Act.
Which leads us all back to that, even if you are to decide that, the best that you can get is a 30-day contract, because that's all you had. If we can even call it a contract, because I think there's some issues as to whether what you had, even though you call it a contract, I'm not sure that it is a contract.
Well, I think that's a merits issue that the trial court still needs to address, in the sense that it's the trial court that has to determine what kind of remedy that it may fashion based upon the causes of action before it. At this point, the question is simply whether the temporary injunction is valid. And of course, the standard of review is abuse of discretion. And that is a very deferential standard. It merely requires that there be some evidence that reasonably supports the trial court's conclusions on the various elements of injunctive relief. Is there some evidence that tends to support the appellee's causes of action? There is some evidence that shows that there was indeed a TOMA violation, that there was indeed a Chapter 252 violation. Is there some evidence that shows that GMS would suffer irreparable harm absent the injunctive relief? Absolutely. The trial court so found, and the evidence supports that. As far as the city's arguments about the equities of the various parties' positions, the trial court expressly found that in the absence of injunctive relief, GMS would suffer significant material harm. At the same time, the trial court expressly found that the city would suffer little, if any, harm from continuing the contract until such time as the parties can litigate the underlying dispute. The city says that the trial court ignored the obvious harm that the city would suffer, but the city cites no evidence of that in its brief. It offered no evidence of that at the temporary injunction hearing. To borrow a phrase from this court's opinion in Burkholder, the city simply didn't freight its side of the equity balance. It had the duty to offer some evidence that it would suffer harm, and it didn't. All that it offers the court now is speculation, and speculation is not evidence.
Well, and I think that that's part of the heartburn that an objective person would look at when they're looking at the briefs, is that a lot of it's speculative. For instance, if we're a year and a half later, 2 years later, and they order a fair process under 252, which they don't have to do, so I don't know how they can do that, then would the city be entitled to a credit? If they say, now you have to have a five-year contract pursuant to that FRP in 2018 or RFP, do you get a credit for the time that they were exercising during the injunction, like a judgment credit? I mean, there just seems to be a lot of speculation about whether there was a contract, whether there wasn't a contract, who would get the benefit in between. What if the contract later is awarded for more money? Would then GMS have a right to recovery for more money that they would have gotten had the contract been entered into, you know, today or the day that they were supposed to award the contract? I mean, there just seems to be a lot of speculation because there was no contract. And do you agree with that there's just a lot of speculation about whether there was a contract, whether there wasn't, and whether or not you would be entitled to a credit if they did award it to you later? Or the city would be entitled to a credit? I know there's a lot of questions in there, but...
And let me try to answer them the best that I can. The credit issue is a merits issue. It hasn't been teed up even in the trial court to this point yet. And again, respectfully, I just don't think it's before the court on the merits of whether the trial court abused its discretion in granting injunctive relief. As far as the specific relief, there are slightly different forms of relief available under TOMA and under Chapter 252. Clearly, under Chapter 252, a taxpaying citizen has the right to enjoin the performance of a contract that violates Chapter 252, and it's our position that the trial court properly, consistently with Chapter 252, enjoined the performance of a contract with Republic that would have violated Chapter 252.
What evidence, let me just interrupt you real quick. What evidence do you have that your client qualifies as a resident of Brownsville?
Well, frankly, that issue wasn't even really before the trial court. It was raised here for the first time on appeal. But the evidence is that we are a property tax paying resident of Brownsville. That's in the record. And the statute itself doesn't distinguish between real property tax-paying residents or property tax-paying residents. Regardless, Michael Bennett clearly is a real property tax-paying resident, and he was added as a plaintiff shortly before the temporary injunction hearing.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt all the answering. I didn't interrupt your train of thought in answering Justice. I had that question in my mind when you said that.
But as to Chapter 252, our right on the face of the statute is to enjoin a contract that violates Chapter 252. Under TOMA, we're entitled to require a do-over for those actions that were taken in violation of TOMA.
Yeah, and I think the problem with that is that you're entitled to a do-over, and you make the city go through the whole 252 process again, and the commissioners can sit there and just go through the process and then reject it again. And then you're back to square one.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe that's what happens after the trial court ultimately resolves the case on the merits. Maybe not.
And I think
maybe with the passage of time and different commissioners, there's a different result.
Well, and that's where, you know, election day comes in, I think. You know?
The people certainly have a remedy themselves for the types of activities that are apparent on the record here and reflect poorly on the city of Brownsville. There's an issue about whether GMS's pleadings adequately raised the specific relief that the trial court awarded the city of tax for different items of injunctive relief that were granted. The first two that the city of tax come right out of GMS's pleadings. I direct the court to page 1978 of the clerk's record, which is the first amended petition that GMS filed a week before the temporary injunction hearing. Regardless, the city didn't preserve any objection to the pleadings at the trial court level. In their reply brief, they cite to pages 245 and 246 of the reporter's record, but nowhere on those pages does the city make any objection that the trial court's relief exceeds what was pleaded in GMS's petition. We respectfully ask the court to affirm the trial court's injunction. Thanks.
You gave us a whole 11 seconds back. Mr. Dinkert.
May it please the court. I'm going to be very brief because I think y'all have covered just about every issue and every argument. I actually agree with counsel when he said that the remedy, what Chapter 252 allows, is to enjoin a made contract done in violation of 252. He's right. That's all it allows. What you didn't hear from him, because he can't say and the statute doesn't allow, is it doesn't allow themselves to enjoin them into a contract, which is what they've asked for and received, not just with the temporary order, but that's what they're asking for with their permanent injunctive relief too. They are clearly asking for something that 252 does not allow. Now, had the city in that 252 process entered into a contract with Republic or entered into a contract with Redfish, they would have had the right, because 252 would have allowed it, to seek injunction of that contract. But that never happened here. And how they get to the leap from what 252 allows to, judge, put us into a contract, put us into a long-term contract, month to month, but leave it there indefinitely. You know, and this goes into their argument that that preserves the status quo. The status
quo. Well, I think that's what you get from reading the hearing from Judge Pate. He didn't want the city of Brownsville to suffer in not having services provided. And so he was like, well, can you continue to provide, you know, pickup? So how was Judge Pate going to preserve, if there was no contract, which obviously there is no contract, how is he to preserve the status quo, if not by doing what he does? And is that truly an abuse of discretion?
I think it is. I think all he could do was allow that contract, that month-to-month contract, to remain in effect as it was, which allowed the city to terminate it with 30 days' notice. The status quo was obliterated here. All it was they had a month-to-month contract, which allowed the city, with 30 days' notice, to terminate that contract. And there were certain terms by which the parties had to comply. Judge Pate essentially did away with the part of the contract that allowed for termination, because the city can't do that anymore, and he added new terms into the contract, the 30-day contract, that didn't exist. So there's no preserving of the status quo here. He turned it completely upside down and allowed them to enjoin themselves into a long-term contract that they're still enjoying the benefits of as we sit here today.
And I guess my question, let me ask you, I'm not that familiar with the actual language of the 30 days. Does it say that that it's automatically renewed, the 30-day extension is automatically renewed unless there is another contract executed, or it gets automatically renewed unless the city gives them 30 days notice?
Yeah, it requires 30 days notice to terminate.
Okay. Okay, so there's nothing in there that says, you know, this contract remains in play or in place unless there is another contract signed, period.
Yeah, no, it's not tied to anything
okay,
like that.
Not tied to anything else. So conceivably, the city could be without services, I guess.
If they didn't make arrangements to, and that's why the 30 days is in there, because if the city elected to give them notice of termination, they would then have time to go get the provider of their choice, which at this point the city cannot do because of the injunction.
I mean, this is kind of speculative, but let's say that they're not providing adequate services, or let's say they're lax in services right now as it stands under the TRO or under the temporary injunction. the city is forced to keep them on, I guess.
That's absolutely correct. I made that argument in my brief. They dismissed it simply by saying that there was testimony. We'll continue to do what we've been doing. Well, that's one of the problems, is they weren't satisfied with the service.
There's no policing power. There's no...
Right. So you're absolutely right. If they decided to get lax with their service, take a day off or 2 days off, or just had a, you know, setback with their personnel and couldn't get to the trash as quickly as possible, the city can't do anything. It is handcuffed to GMS with this injunction.
Do you believe that constitutes abuse of discretion?
Absolutely, we believe it does. And I think everything else I believe was covered adequately.
Do you have any further questions?
I do not.
Then we will thank you for your 5 minutes back to the court.
Thank you.